Every time he appears, it means trouble. He's coming to Storlock. Has something to do with us, doesn't it? Will ventured, watching his uncle's face. Flick shook his head uncertainly. He's come here for a purpose, sure enough, and he's called us over to say something more than hello and how are you. Whatever it is he has to say, it won't be anything we want to hear. I know that much. It never has been before, and I see no reason to expect anything different this time around. He stopped abruptly and faced his nephew. You watch yourself in there with him, Will. He is not to be trusted. I'll be careful, Uncle Flick, but I don't think there is much to worry about, Will replied. We both know something of Al-Anon, don't we? Besides, you'll be there to keep an eye on things. I fully intend to. Flick turned and they continued walking. Just remember what I said. Moments later they mounted the porch steps of the rest center and stepped inside. The center was a long, low building constructed of stone and mortar walls and a clay-tiled roof. A large, comfortably furnished lobby opened on either side into hallways that disappeared into the wings of the center, where numerous small rooms provided for the care of the sick and injured. As they entered, one of the white-robed stores in attendance came up to greet them. He beckoned wordlessly, then led them down a long, empty hallway. At its end was a single closed door. The store knocked once, turned, and left. Will glanced uneasily at Flick, but the elder Ohmsford was staring fixedly at the closed door. Together, they waited. Then the door swung open and Al-Anon stood before them. He looked for all the world as if he had not been injured at all. No wounds were visible. The black robes that cloaked his tall frame were clean of blood. His face was somewhat drawn but showed no sign of any pain. His penetrating gaze settled on the veilman for a moment, then one hand motioned toward a small table with four chairs set about it. Why don't we sit there while we talk? He made the suggestion seem almost an order. They entered and seated themselves on the chairs. The room was windowless and bare of furnishings except for the table and chairs and a large bed. Will glanced about briefly, then turned his attention to the druid. Al-Anon had been described to him by both Flick and Shay on dozens of occasions, and he looked now exactly as he had been described. But how could that be, Will wondered, when the descriptions were of a man they had not seen since before the time of his birth? Well, here we are, Flick said finally, when it appeared that no one was ever going to say anything. Al-Anon smiled faintly. It seems so. You look well enough for a man who was half dead just a few hours earlier. The stores are very adept at their art, as you of all people should know, the druid replied rather too pleasantly. But I'm afraid I do not feel half so well as I should. How are you, Flick? Older and wiser, I hope, the veilman declared meaningfully. Al-Anon did not respond. His gaze shifted abruptly to Will. For a moment he said nothing further, his dark face inscrutable as he studied the younger Ohmsford. Will sat quietly and did not turn away, though the druid's eyes made him uneasy. Then slowly Al-Anon leaned forward in his chair, his great hands settling on the tabletop and folding together. I need your help, Will Ohmsford, he stated quietly. Both veilmen stared at him. I need you to come with me into the Westland. I knew it, muttered Flick, shaking his head. Al-Anon smiled ruefully. It is comforting to know, Flick, that some things in this life never change. You are certainly proof of that. Would it matter at all if I were to tell you that Will's help is needed not for me, but for the elven people, and in particular a young elven girl? No, it would not, the veilman replied, without a moment's hesitation. He's not going, and that's the end of it. Wait a minute, Uncle Flick, Will interjected quickly. It may well be that I'm not going, but I would like to be the one who makes that decision. At least we can hear something more about what it is that I'm needed to do. Flick ignored the reprimand. Believe me, you do not want to hear another word. This is exactly how the trouble begins. This is exactly how it began for your grandfather 50 years ago. He looked quickly at Al-Anon. Isn't that true? Isn't this exactly how things started when you came to Shady Vale and told us all about the sword? Al-Anon nodded. It is. There, you see? Flick declared triumphantly. Exactly the same. I'll wager this journey you've got planned for him is dangerous too, isn't it? Again the druid nodded. Well, then, the veilman sat back, satisfaction etched into his bearded face. I should think that settles the matter. You're asking too much. He's not going. Al-Anon's dark eyes glittered. He must go. Flick looked startled. He must? The druid nodded. You will see why, Flick. Once I have explained what has happened in the Four Lands these past few days. Listen closely to me, Veilman. He edged his chair closer to the table and leaned forward. A long time ago, a very long time ago, before the Great Wars and the evolution of the new races, even before the development of man as a civilized species, there was a terrible war fought between creatures that for the most part no longer exist. Some of these creatures were good and caring. They revered the land and sought to protect and preserve it against misuse and waste. For them all life was sacred. But there were others who were evil and selfish. Their ways were destructive and harmful. They took from the land and from its life without need or purpose. All were creatures whose physical characteristics and capabilities differed in the main from your own. That is to say, their appearance was different from yours, and they were capable of behavior no longer innate to the men of this world. In particular, they possessed, to varying degrees, powers of magic. At least we would call it magic, or sorcery, or the mystic. Such power was common at that time, though some among these creatures possessed the power to a greater extent than others. Thus their capacity for good or evil was enhanced proportionately. All of these creatures, both good and evil, existed together in the world, and because man had not yet developed beyond a primitive life form existing within a narrow geographical space, the world was theirs alone. It had been so for centuries. But their existence together had never been harmonious. They lived in continuing conflict, for they worked at cross purposes, the good to preserve, the evil to destroy. From time to time, the balance of power between the conflicting sides would shift, as first the good and then the evil would dominate the drift of things. The struggle between them intensified through the years until finally, after centuries had passed, without resolution of the conflict, the leaders in each camp banded together all who supported them, and the war began. This was not a war the like of which we have seen since. This was not a war on the order of the Great Wars, for the Great Wars employed power of such awesome proportion that the men who wielded it lost control entirely and were engulfed in the resulting cataclysm. Rather, it was a war in which power and strength were skillfully employed at each turn, in which the creatures involved stood toe to toe in battle and lived and died on the skill they wielded. This was like the wars of the races which have dominated the history of the New World. In the race wars, the warlock lord perverted the thinking of those who served him, turning them against one another so that in the end he might enslave and rule them all. But But in this war there was never any deceit or illusion that swayed those who fought it. Good and evil were polarized from the beginning. No one stood aside in neutrality, for there were no neutral corners to be found. This was a war fought to determine forever the character and mode of evolution of life on the earth across which it was waged. It was a war that would decide whether the land would be forever preserved or forever desecrated. Each camp had resolved once and for all to achieve total victory over the other. For the creatures of evil, if they were defeated, it meant banishment. For the creatures of good, if they lost, it meant annihilation. So the war was fought. A terrible, monstrous war that I will not even attempt to describe, for there would be no point in doing so. For our purposes here, it is only important that you know that the evil ones were defeated. Their power was broken, and they were driven back and finally trapped. Those who had defeated them used their powers to create a forbidding, a wall of imprisonment behind which the evil was to be placed. Their prison was not of this world nor any world, but a black hole of emptiness and isolation, where nothing but the evil would be permitted to exist. Into this hole the evil was banished, sealed away behind the wall of the forbidding for all time. The strength behind the forbidding was a marvelous tree called an elchris. The creatures of good created the elchris out of the earth's life source, which they called the blood fire, and out of their own power. They gave her life, so that by her presence in the world the forbidding might endure long after they themselves were gone, long after the world they had struggled so long and desperately to preserve had altered and evolved beyond any recognition. Her life span was not to be measured by any standard that they possessed, but so long as she lived, the forbidding continued, and so long as the forbidding continued, the evil would remain shut within its prison. He settled back in his chair, easing his tall frame gingerly away from the table to relieve cramped muscles, his arms slipping down into his lap. His dark eyes stayed locked on those of the Veilmen. It was believed that the Elchris would live forever. Not by those who gave her life, for they knew that all things must eventually pass away, but by those who followed them, by all who nurtured and loved and honored this wondrous tree that was their protector for countless centuries. For them the Elchris became a symbol of permanency. She survived the destruction of the old world and the holocaust of the great wars. She survived the race wars and the power of the warlock lord, and she survived after every other living thing that had existed with her had passed away. Everything but the earth herself, and even the earth had changed while the Elchris had remained constant. He paused. So the legend grew. The Elchris would live forever. It was eternal. That belief never faltered. His face lifted slightly. Until now. Now the belief is shattered. The Elchris is dying. The forbidding begins to erode. The evil ones imprisoned within begin to break free once more and come back into this world that was once theirs. And these creatures caused your injuries, Will surmised. Alanon nodded. Some already walk the four lands. Though I thought to keep my presence secret, they have discovered me. They found me at Perenor within the Druid's Keep and very nearly finished me. Flick looked alarmed. Are they still searching for you? They are. But I have reason to believe that they won't be so quick to find me this time. That doesn't reassure me much, the Veilman grumbled, glancing toward the doorway of the little room a bit apprehensively. Al-Anon let the remark pass. You may remember, Flick, that I once told to Shay and to you the history of the races. I told you how all of the races evolved from the old race of man following the destruction wrought by the great wars. All of the races but one. The elves. I told you that the elves were always there. Do you remember? Flick grunted. I remember. That was something else you never explained. I said that theirs was another story for another time. That time is now, in part at least, though I don't propose to digress on the history of the elven people at any great length, but some things you should know. We have spoken only in the abstract of the creatures that fought this war of good and evil that culminated in the creation of the Elkris. We must give them identity. All were creatures that became part of the old legends of faery when men emerged from the darkness of barbarism and began to populate and build upon the world. They were creatures of magics, as I have said, both great and small. There were diverse species, some all good, some all bad, some whose individual peoples divided and went in opposite ways. They had names that you will recognize. Fairies, sprites, goblins, wraiths, and the like. The new races, though human in ancestry, were named from four of the more numerous and best recorded of these creatures of supposed legend. Dwarves, gnomes, trolls, and elves. Except, of course, that the elves are different. They are different because they are not simply a legend reborn. They are the legend survived. The elven people are the descendants of the fairy creatures that existed in the old world. Now, wait a minute, Flick cut in quickly. You mean to say that the elven people are the same elven people that all the old legends tell about? That there really were elves in the old world? Certainly there were elves in the old world, just as there were trolls and dwarves and all the other creatures that gave birth to the legends. The only difference is that all of the others have been gone from the world for centuries, while the elves have remained. They have altered, of course. They have evolved considerably. They were forced to adapt. Flick looked as if he didn't understand one word of what he was hearing. There were elves in the old world, he repeated incredulously. That is just not possible. Of course it's possible, the druid replied calmly. Well, how did they survive the great wars? How did man survive the great wars? But the old histories tell us of man. They do not mention a single word about elves, the veilman snapped. Elves were a fairy tale people. If there really were elves in the old world, where were they? Right where they had always been. Man just couldn't see them. Now you're telling me elves were invisible? Flick threw up his hands. I don't believe any of this. You didn't believe any of what I told you about Shay and the Sword of Shannara either, if I remember correctly, Al-Anon pointed out, the faintest hint of laughter on his lips. I don't see what any of this has to do with why the elves need my help, Will interjected, heading off another outburst from Flick. The druid nodded. I'll try to explain, if Flick will just be patient with me for a moment longer. The history of the elves is important to this discussion for one reason only. The elves were the ones who conceived the idea of the Elkris and who brought her into being. It was the elves who gave her life and afterwards cared for her down through the ages. Her protection and well-being are entrusted to an order of elven youth called Chosen. For a single year, the Chosen stand in service to the tree, their task to see to it that she is properly looked after. At the end of that year, they are replaced. It has been so since the tree's creation. 1 year of service only. The chosen are revered and honored among the elven people. Only a few are ever selected to serve, and those who do so are guaranteed a position of high esteem in the elven culture. All of which brings us to the present. As I have told you, the Elcris is dying. A few days earlier she made this known to the Chosen. She was able to do this because she is a sentient being and possesses the ability to communicate. She revealed to them that her death was inevitable and close. She revealed as well what the elven legends had foretold, what the first elves had known, but what generations of elves thereafter had virtually forgotten. That although the Elcris must die in the manner of other living creatures, unlike them, she could be reborn. Yet her rebirth must depend heavily on the efforts of the Chosen. One among them would be required to bear her seed in search of the Earth's life source, the Bloodfire. Only one of the Chosen presently in her service could do this. She told them where the Bloodfire might be found and bade them make preparations to seek it out. He paused. But before this could be done, some of the evil ones locked within the forbidding broke free, finding the wall sufficiently weakened as the strength of the Elcris began to fail. One slipped into the elven city of Arbalon, where the Elcris stands, and killed the Chosen it found there, believing that with their deaths any chance for a rebirth would be ended. I arrived too late to prevent this from happening, but I spoke with the Elcris and discovered through her that one of the Chosen still remains alive, a young girl who was not within the city when the others were killed. Her name is Amberley. I left Arbalon in search of her. He leaned forward once more. But the evil ones have learned of her also. They sought once already to prevent me from reaching her, and very nearly succeeded. They will certainly try again if they have the chance to do so, but they do not know where she can be found, nor, for the moment at least, do they know where I am. If I am quick enough, I should be able to reach her and return her safely to Arbalon before they discover me again. "Then I should think that you are wasting valuable time conversing with us," Flick declared firmly. "You should be on your way to the girl." The druid ignored him, though his face darkened slightly. "Even though I return Amberley to Arbalon, there are problems still that must be dealt with. As the last of the Chosen, it will fall to her to bear the Elcris's seed in quest of the Bloodfire. No one, myself included, knows exactly where the fire can be found. Once the Elcris knew, but the world she remembers is gone now. She gave the elves a name, Safehold. It is a name that means nothing to them, a name from the old world. When I left Arbalon, I traveled first to Paranor to search the druid histories compiled by the Council after the Great Wars, histories which record the mysteries of the old world. Reading through those histories, I was able to discover the country within which Safehold lies. Still, the exact location of the Bloodfire must be discovered by those who seek it. And suddenly Will Ohmsford realized why it was that Alanon wanted him to go into the Westland. He realized it, and still he could not believe it. "Amberley cannot undertake this search alone," Alanon continued. "The country into which she must go is dangerous, much too dangerous for a young elven girl to travel by herself. It will be a difficult journey at best. Those who have crossed through the forbidding will continue to seek her out. If they find her, she will have no protection against them. She must not be harmed in any way. She is the last hope of her people. If the Elkris is not reborn, the Forbidding will eventually fail altogether, and the evil locked within it will be loose once more upon the earth. There will be war with the elves that they cannot, in all probability, win. If they are destroyed, the evil will move into the other lands as well. It will grow stronger as it comes, as is the nature of beings such as these. In the end, the races will be devoured.
But you will be there to help her, Will began, searching for a way out of the trap he felt closing about him.
I cannot be there to help her, Al-Anon cut in quickly. There was a long silence. Al-Anon spread his hands on the table. There is good reason for this, Will Ohmsford. I have told you that the evil already begins to break through the wall of the Forbidding. The Elkris will grow steadily weaker. As she does so, the creatures she imprisons will grow bolder. They will continue to push against the wall of the Forbidding. They will continue to break through. Eventually, they will tear down the wall entirely. When this happens, they will converge upon the elven nation and attempt to destroy it. This may very well happen long before the Bloodfire is found. There is also a possibility that the Bloodfire may never be found, or that it may be found too late. In either case, the elven people must be prepared to stand and fight. But some of the creatures within the Forbidding are very powerful. At least one possesses sorcery very nearly as great as my own. The elves will have no defense against such power. Their own magic is lost. The druids who once aided them are gone. There is only me. If I leave them and go with Amberlee, they will be defenseless. I cannot do that. I must give them whatever aid I can. Yet someone must go with Amberlee, someone who possesses power enough to resist the evil that will pursue her, someone who can be trusted to do everything humanly possible to protect her. That someone is you.
What are you talking about? Flick exclaimed in exasperation. What possible help can Will be against creatures such as these? Creatures have very nearly succeeded in doing you in. You don't mean for him to use the Sword of Shannara?
Al-Anon shook his head. The power of the sword works only against illusion. The evil we face is very real, very tangible. The sword would have no power against it. Flick almost came to his feet.
What then?
The druid's eyes were dark and filled with insight, and Will Ohmsford felt his heart sink.
The elf stones.
Flick was aghast.
The elf stones? But Shay has the elf stones.
Will put his hand quickly on the other's arm.
No, Uncle Flick, I have them.
He groped within his tunic and then withdrew a small leather pouch.
Grandfather gave them to me when I left Shady Vale to come to Storlock. He told me that he no longer had need of them and that he thought they should belong to me.
His voice was shaking.
It's strange. I only took them to please him. Not because I ever thought that I would use them. I've never even tried.
It would do you no good, Will. Flick turned back hurriedly to Al-Anon.
He knows. No one but Shay could ever use the elf stones. They are useless to anyone else.
Al-Anon's expression did not change. That is not entirely true, Flick. They can only be used by one to whom they are freely given. I gave them to Shay to use when I warned him to flee the Vale to Cullhaven. They remained his until he gave them to Will. Now they belong to Will. Their power is his to invoke, just as it was once Shay's.
Flick looked desperate. You can give them back, he insisted, turning once more to Will, seeing the confusion in his eyes. Or you can give them to someone else. anyone else. You don't have to keep them. You don't have to become involved in any of this madness.
Al-Anon shook his head. Flick, he is already involved.
But what of my plans to become a healer? Will interjected suddenly. What of the time and work I've put into that? Becoming a healer is all that I have ever wanted to do, and I am finally on my way to doing it. Am I expected just to give it all up?
If you refuse your aid in this matter, how can you then become a healer? The druid's voice turned hard. A healer must give whatever help he can, whenever he can, in any way that he can. It is not something he can pick and choose. If you refuse to go, and all that I have foreseen comes to pass, as I am certain that it then will, how will you live with yourself, knowing that you never even tried to prevent it? Will flushed.
But when will I be able to return again?
I don't know. It may be a long time.
And even if I come with you, can you be certain that the power of the Elf Stones will be strong enough to protect this girl?
Al-Anon's face closed in about itself, dark, secretive. I cannot. Such power as the Elf Stones possess draws its strength from the holder. Shay never tested their limits. You may have to.
Can you give me no assurances, then?
The Veilman's voice had dropped to a whisper.
None.
The druid's gaze never left him.
Still, you must come.
Will slumped back in his chair, stunned.
It seems I have no choice.
Of course you have a choice, Flick snapped angrily.
Will you give up everything for no other reason than this, that Al-Anon says you must? Will you go with him for that alone?
Will's eyes lifted.
Didn't you, Uncle Flick? Grandfather and you? To search out the Sword of Shannara?
Flick hesitated uncertainly. Then he reached over and took his nephew's hands in his own, clasping them tightly.
You were too quick in this, Will. I warned you of Al-Anon. Now you listen to me. I see more in this than you. There is something hidden behind the druid's words. I can feel it.
His voice tightened and the lines in his gray bearded face creased even more deeply.
I am afraid for you. It is because I am afraid that I speak to you as I do. You are like my own son. I don't want to lose you.
I know, Will whispered.
I know.
Flick straightened.
Then don't go. Let Al-Anon find another.
The druid shook his head. I cannot, Flick. There is no other. There is only Will. His eyes again sought those of the young Veilman. You must come.
Let me go instead,
Flick offered suddenly, a hint of desperation in his voice.
Will can give the Elf Stones to me, and I can watch over the elven girl. Al-Anon, we have traveled together before.
But the druid was already shaking his head no. Flick. You cannot come, he said gently. Your heart is greater than your strength, Veilman. The journey that lies ahead will be long and hard, and must be made by a younger man. He paused. Our travels together are over, Flick. There was a long silence, and then the druid turned again to Will Ohmsford, waiting. The Veilman looked at his uncle. They stared at each other wordlessly for a moment, Flick's gray eyes uncertain, Will's now steady. Flick saw that the decision had been made. Almost imperceptibly, he nodded. You must do what you feel is right, he mumbled, reluctance sounding in his every word. Will turned to Al-Anon.
I will come with you.
Chapter 9. Early the next morning, Al-Anon came to Will Ohmsford and told him that they were leaving Storlock at once. Dark and grim-visaged, the druid appeared at the door of the Veilman's cottage without a word of forewarning, and while Will gave thought to arguing against such an abrupt departure, something in the big man's face and voice convinced him that he should not. Last evening, when they had parted company, there had been no urgency in the druid's behavior. Now there clearly was. Whatever it was that had persuaded Al-Anon to make this decision, it was compelling. Wordlessly, the Veilman packed his few belongings and latched the door of the cottage behind him as he followed the druid out. It was raining once more as a new storm approached from out of the northwest, and the dawn skies were heavy and leaden. Al-Anon led the Veilman up the muddied roadway, his tall form wrapped in the black robe, his cowled head bent slightly against a steadily rising wind. A handful of white-robed stores waited to receive them on the steps of the rest center, with a small kit for Will and provisions for the journey. Artak was saddled and shaking his head with impatience, and Al-Anon mounted the black at once, a gingerliness in his movements suggesting that his wounds were not yet fully healed. A wiry gray gelding named Spitter was given to Will, and he had one foot in the stirrup when Flick came dashing up, bearded face dripping and flushed. Hastily, his uncle pulled him back into the shelter of the rest center's covered porch. "They just told me," he panted, wiping the rain from his eyes. "I'm surprised they bothered." He glanced angrily toward Al-Anon. "Is it necessary that you leave so quickly?" Will nodded slowly. "I think something may have made it necessary." Frustration and concern showed in Flick's eyes. "It is not too late to rethink your decision in all this," he whispered harshly, and would have said more, but Will was already shaking his head. "Very well. I'll tell your grandfather what has happened, though I am certain he won't like it any better than I do. Be careful, Will. Remember what I said about all of us having our limitations?" Will nodded. They said their goodbyes quickly and gruffly, almost as if they were afraid to express what they were really feeling, their faces fixed and drawn as they exchanged uneasy glances and hurriedly embraced. Then Al-Anon and he were riding away. Flick, the stores, and the village became dark shadows that faded into the mist and gray of the Eastland forests and disappeared from view. The druid and the Veilman rode west out of Storlock to the edge of the Rab Plains, then turned south. Al-Anon paused long enough to tell Will that the first leg of their journey would take them below the Silver River to a small village on the western edge of the Lower Anar called Havenstead. It was at Havenstead that they would find Amberley. The druid did not volunteer anything further on the matter, and Will did not ask. Rain washed over them in sheets as the storm worsened. Keeping within the fringe of the forest land, they bent their heads over their horses' necks and rode without speaking. As they traveled, Will's thoughts drifted back to the events of the previous evening. Even now, he was not sure exactly why he had decided to go with the druid, and that disturbed him. Surely he should be able to explain why he had agreed to such an improbable journey, to himself at least, if to no one else. Yet he could not. There had been sufficient time to think about his reasons for making the decision, and indeed he had thought about little else. Hindsight should have lent clarity to his actions. It did not. Rather, he felt a lingering sense of confusion. Everything seemed to jumble together in his mind, all the disparate, incomplete reasoning, all the emotions that intertwined and colored. They would not sort themselves out for him. They would not arrange themselves in a neat, orderly fashion. They merely shuffled about like stray sheep, and he chased after them hopelessly. He wanted to believe that he had chosen to go because he was needed. If all that Al-Anon had told him were true, and he felt it was, despite Flick's obvious doubts, then he could be of great service to the elven people and particularly to the girl Amberley. But who was he fooling? He had no idea at all whether he could use the elf stones that his grandfather had entrusted to him. Suppose their power was beyond him? Suppose Al-Anon was wrong in thinking that the elf stones could be passed down to him. Suppose anything at all. The fact was that he had made a rather impulsive decision, and now he must live with it. On the other hand, the impulsiveness of the decision did not necessarily detract from its merit. If he possessed aid to offer the elves, he must extend that aid. He must at least try to help them. Besides, his grandfather would have gone. He knew that as surely as he knew anything. Shay Ohmsford would have gone, had Al-Anon asked him, just as he had gone on his quest for the Sword of Shannara. Will could do no less. He took a deep breath. Yes, he had made the right decision in going, and he believed that he had made that decision for the right reasons, though they seemed jumbled and out of order to him now. What bothered him most, he realized suddenly, had nothing to do with the decision itself or the reasons for that decision. It had to do with Al-Anon. Will would have liked to believe that the decision to go with the druid had been his own. Yet the more he considered the matter, the more certain he became that the decision had not really been his at all. It had been Al-Anon's. Oh, he had spoken the words as if they were his own, spoken them bravely and despite his uncle's warnings. Yet he knew that the druid had been able to foresee exactly what it would take to persuade Will to speak those words, and he had directed the conversation accordingly. Somehow he had known what the younger Veilman's reactions would be, what Flick's would be, how the two would interact, and how his own comments would influence them. He had known all this and used that knowledge accordingly. Shay Ohmsford had once told Will that Al-Anon possessed the ability to see into the minds of other men, to know their thoughts. Will understood now exactly what his grandfather had been talking about. Thus he had committed himself. It was not something that could be undone, even if he should choose to do so, and he did not. But from here forward he would be on his guard against such clever manipulation by the druid. Insofar as it was possible for him to do so, he would look beyond the words and actions of the big man to the reasons that lay behind them, the better to see where it was that he was being led. Will Ohmsford was nobody's fool. He had been looking after himself for several years, and he was not about to quit doing so now. He must be wary of the druid. He would trust him, but not blindly and not without proper consideration. Perhaps he could be of service to the elves and to the girl Amberley. He did not reject that possibility simply because of what he felt about the manner in which his cooperation in all this had been secured. But he would be careful to choose his own manner of giving aid. He would be careful to decide for himself whose interests he might best look after. He would accept nothing as he found it. His face lifted guardedly, and he peered through the rain at the dark form riding ahead of him. Al-Anon, last of the druids, a being who came from another age, whose powers dwarfed anything known to this current world. And Will must both trust him and yet not trust him. He felt a moment of deep consternation. What had he gotten himself into? Perhaps Flick had been right after all. Perhaps he would have done well to have given a little more thought to his decision. But it was too late for that now. Too late as well for thoughts such as these. He shook his head. There was little point in dwelling on it further. He would be well advised to turn his thoughts in another direction. He spent the remainder of the day trying unsuccessfully to do so. The rain turned to drizzle as the day lengthened, then at last died away entirely in the cold gray of early evening. Thunderclouds continued to blanket the skies as nightfall turned from gray to black, and the air filled with mist that wandered at the forest's edge like a child lost. Al-Anon turned into the shelter of the great trees, and they made camp in a small clearing several hundred yards from the borders of the Rab. Behind them, rising above the roof of the forest, was the dark wall of the Wolfstag, little more than a deeper shade of black against the night. Despite the damp, they managed to salvage enough dry wood and kindling to make a small fire, and the flames lent some warmth to the evening chill. Travel cloaks were hung on lines stretched overhead, and the horses were tethered close by. They consumed a sparse meal of cold beef, fruits, and nuts that they had packed before leaving Storlock, exchanging only a few perfunctory words as they ate. The druid sat in brooding silence, preoccupied with his own thoughts, as he had been ever since they had left the village, and seemingly uninterested in carrying on any sort of conversation. But Will had determined to learn something more of what lay ahead, and he had no intention of waiting any longer to begin talking about it. When they had finished their meal, he eased himself a bit closer to the fire, making sure the movement caught Alanon's attention. "Can we talk a bit?" he asked carefully, bearing in mind his grandfather's many tales of the big man's uncertain temperament. The druid stared at him expressionlessly for a moment, then nodded. "Can you tell me something more about the history of the elven people?" Will decided the conversation should begin there. Alanon smiled faintly. "Very well. What would you like to know, Will Ormsford?" The Veilman hesitated. "Last night you told us that even though the histories of the Old World make no mention of the elven people, other than in fairy tales and in folklore, they were a real people nevertheless, just as men were. You said they were there, but humans couldn't see them. I didn't understand that."
"You didn't?" The big man seemed amused. "Well then, you shall have an explanation. Simply put, the elves have always been creatures of the forest, but more so in the times before the Great Wars. In those days, as I've told you before, they were creatures of magic. They possessed the ability to blend in quite naturally with their surroundings, much as if they were a bush or plant that you might pass by 1,000 times and never notice. Humans couldn't see them because they did not know how to look for them."
"But they weren't invisible?"
"Hardly.
Just difficult to see."
"Yes, yes." There was a touch of annoyance in the druid's answer.
"Why don't we have trouble seeing them now?"
Alanon straightened himself.
"You're not listening. In the Old World, the elves were creatures of magic, as were all the creatures of fairy. They are creatures of magic no longer. They are men, just as you are a man. Their magic is lost to them."
"How did this happen?"
Will settled his elbows against his knees and propped his chin in his hands, somewhat in the manner of a curious child.
"That is not so easy to explain," the druid advised him. "But I can see that you will not be satisfied until I've tried, so I will attempt to do so."
He leaned forward slightly.
"After the creation of the Elkris, after the banishment of the creatures of evil magic from the earth, the elves and their fairy brethren drifted apart once more. It was natural enough that this should happen, since they had united in the first place only for the purpose of defeating their common enemy, and once that was accomplished, there was little left to keep them together. Beyond their general concern in preserving the earth as a homeland, they had almost nothing in common. Each species of creature had its own way of life, its own habits, its own interests. Elves, dwarves, sprites, gnomes, trolls, witches, and all the rest were as different from each other as the beasts of the forest from the fish in the sea. Humankind had not yet begun to emerge from its early, primitive existence, and would not do so for hundreds of years to come. Fairy creatures paid the humans little attention, and indeed there seemed little reason to do so. After all, at this stage in time, humans were simply a higher form of animal life, possessing greater innate intelligence than other animals, but lesser instincts. The elves and their brethren did not foresee the influence that humans would eventually have upon the development on the earth.
The druid paused. It was something they could have foreseen had they paid closer attention to the differences between themselves and humankind. Two differences were of particular importance. The elves and their brethren did not procreate rapidly. Humans did. The elves, for example, were one of the more populous fairy people, yet their longer lifespans resulted in fewer births. Many of the other fairy creatures gave birth only once every several hundred years, but humans had frequent multiple births within the family unit, and their population grew quickly. In the beginning, the creatures of magic far outnumbered the humans. Within 1,000 years' time, that situation reversed itself dramatically. Thereafter, the human population expanded steadily while the fairy population began to diminish. But I'll get to that in a moment. The second difference between the elves and their brethren and humankind had to do with the ability to adapt, or lack thereof. The elves were creatures of the forest land. They seldom left the shelter of their woods. It was the same with most of the others. Each resided within a particular geographic area, a carefully bounded terrain. It had always been so. Some lived within the forests, some within the rivers and seas, some within the mountains, some within the plainlands. They had adapted their way of life to the terrain that served as their homeland. They could not and would not live anywhere else. But humans were more adaptable. They lived everywhere. The forests, the rivers, the mountains, the plains, they claimed it all. Thus their expansion as their population grew came naturally, easily. They adapted to any change in environment. The elves and their brethren resisted all change.
Elanon paused, then smiled faintly. There was a time, Will Ohmsford, when life in the old world was much as life is now, when humans lived and worked and played much as the races do in this world. Does that surprise you?
Will nodded.
A little, I guess.
The druid shook his head. There was such a time. It was then that the elves should have come forward and joined with humans to shape their world. But they did not. Neither they nor their brethren. They chose instead to remain hidden within their forest land, observers only, still believing that their own existence would not be affected by the development of humankind. They saw no threat to themselves. The humans possessed no magic, and their ways were not destructive. Not then. So the elves kept to their policy of isolation, foolishly thinking it could always be so. It was their undoing. The human population continued to expand and to develop. As time wore on, they learned of the elves and their brethren. But because the fairy creatures chose concealment as their way of life, they earned the distrust of humans. They were deemed creatures of ill fortune, creatures who spied and connived against others, creatures who performed acts of mischief, and whose favorite pastime was to discover new ways of making the lives of hard-working humans more difficult. There was some truth to the charges, since a few of the fairy creatures did indeed delight in tormenting humans with small acts of enchantment, but by and large the reputation was undeserved. In any case, the elves and their brethren chose to ignore it all. The attitude of humankind toward them did not concern them. Their sole concern was with the preservation and protection of the land and the living things within it, and this they could accomplish very well, despite the ill feelings humans bore them. Then even this state of affairs began to change. Humans continued to populate the Earth with increasing rapidity, growing, expanding, now building cities and fortresses, now sailing the seas in search of new lands, now pushing back the wilderness about them. They began, for the first time, seriously to affect the character of the land, changing whole regions for habitation and consumption needs. The elves were forced to move deeper and deeper into the forest lands that were their homes, as the human population cut away the trees and brush. All of the fairy creatures found their homelands being encroached upon by this expansion until finally, for some, there were no homes at all.
But didn't they resist this intrusion? Will interrupted suddenly.
It was far too late for that, Alanon replied, his smile bitter. By this time, many of the fairy creatures had become extinct, some by failure to reproduce sufficient young, some by their failure to adapt to a changing environment. Those who remained were no longer able to unite as they once had done. It had been hundreds of years since their war with the fairy creatures of evil magic, and they had scattered far and wide about the earth and long since lost contact with one another. Worst of all, they no longer had their own magic. When the evil magic had flourished upon the earth, there had been need for good magic to withstand it, but once that evil had been banished, the need for the good magic was past. The fairy creatures ceased using most of it. As time passed, much of it was forgotten altogether. Human beings used no magic of any consequence, so the elves and their brethren saw no need for the very powerful magics that had once been employed to defeat their evil counterparts. By the time they recognized the need for it again, it was lost to them, all but a small part of it. Thus their resistance to the expansion of the human population into their homelands was weakened badly. At first they fought very hard, using all the power they still possessed to stop what was happening. It availed them nothing. There were too many humans and too few of them. Their magic was ineffective. It won them small victories, brief respites, nothing more. They were simply overwhelmed in the end, driven from their homes to find new ones or to perish, driven out in the final analysis by sciences and technologies against which they had no real defense.
And the elves? What of them? Will asked quietly.
They learned to survive. Their population dwindled, but they did not become extinct, as did so many of the others. They remained within their forest land, moving steadily deeper, hidden now completely from the humans who had come to occupy almost the whole of the earth. They watched in horror the destruction that was being performed on their world. They watched it being stripped of its resources and its animal life. They watched as its ecological balance was utterly and irreversibly disrupted. They watched the humans war between themselves incessantly as the separate governments struggled to achieve domination over one another. They watched, and they waited, and they prepared, for they saw how it all must end.
The Great Wars,
the Veilman anticipated the druid. The Great Wars, Alanon nodded. The elves foresaw that such horrors would come. They used what magic they still possessed in an effort to preserve themselves and a few carefully chosen treasures of their past, among these the Elkris from the Holocaust that followed. It was a remarkable effort, and it allowed them to survive. Most of the other fairy creatures were destroyed. A small number of humans survived, though it was not through their foresight that they did so. They survived because there were so many of them in so many different parts of the earth that the Holocaust simply missed a few of them. But everything that the humans had built was destroyed. All of their vast, sprawling civilization was erased. The old world was reduced to a barren, desolate wilderness. For hundreds of years after, all life was caught up in a savage struggle to stay alive. The few creatures that remained alive in this new world were forced to adapt to the primitive environment about them, an environment in which nature had been altered beyond recognition. Humankind was changed forever. From out of the old race of humans emerged four new and distinct races. Men, dwarves, gnomes, and trolls. It was believed, and is still believed by most, that the elves were a fifth race born of the Holocaust. For the new races, it was the beginning of life. Most of the history of the old world was quickly forgotten. Much of the old ways vanished. The elves kept much of their history and their tradition. Only their magic was lost to them. But this time it was lost for good. Their need to adapt resulted in changes that would not otherwise have occurred, changes that brought them closer culturally and physiologically to the new races. Reborn humans and surviving elves assimilated together in their new world until finally, inexorably, they became much the same. And when at last, almost 1,000 years after the great wars had ended, the new races began to emerge from the primitive lives they had endured while struggling to survive the after effects of the Holocaust, the elves stood with them. No longer would they hide in their forest land as impartial observers to the development of a world. This time they would be a part of that development, working openly with the new races to be certain that men did not travel a second time that roadway which had almost ended with the destruction of all life. Thus did the elves, through the druid Gallifile, convene the first council at Perenor. Thus did the elves seek to turn the races from an ill-advised search for the old sciences of energy and power, counseling instead a more cautious approach to life's mysteries. Thus did they seek to regain the small magics they had lost, believing these arts would help them best in their efforts to preserve their new world and its life.
"Yet the elves have no magic," Will reminded the big man. "Only the druids did."
"The druids and a handful of others scattered through the land," Alanon corrected. He seemed to lose himself momentarily. When he spoke again, his voice was distant. "The druids learned early of the dangers inherent in the search for the lost magic. A druid named Brona taught them well. His need to explore the limits of the magic destroyed him, created in his physical shell the creature we know as the Warlock Lord. When the druids realized what hunger for the magic had done to him, they forbade further exploration. The magic they had found was not altogether good nor altogether bad. It was simply powerful, too powerful for mortal men to master. For a time, it was left alone. Then Brona caught and killed all of the druids at Perenor, signaling the start of the second war of the races, and suddenly there was only Bremen left to teach the magic. Then, when he was gone, there was only me."
He trailed off momentarily, dark eyes narrowing as he stared down into the little fire at their feet. Then he looked back suddenly at Will.
"What else would you know, Veilman?"
The tone of his voice was sharp, almost angry. Its abruptness caught Will by surprise, but he kept his gaze steady, forcing his eyes to meet the druid's.
"What else would you have me know?" he replied quietly.
Alanon said nothing, waiting. There was a long, uncomfortable silence as the two men faced each other. At last the Veilman looked away again, poking idly at the embers of their fire with the toe of one boot.
"These
creatures that were shut within the place beyond the forbidding.
What of them? He asked finally.
How have they survived for so many years? Why have they not perished?
Al-Anon's dark expression did not change.
Call them demons, for that is what they have become. They were sent to a non-place, a dark emptiness beyond any living world. Within that darkness there was no passing of time to bring age and death. The elves failed to realize this, I suppose, or perhaps thought it of little importance, since their only concern was to remove the evil from their own world. In any case, the demons did not die. Rather, they multiplied. The evil that lived within them fed upon itself and grew stronger. It bred new life. For evil left to itself, Veilman, does not simply perish. It thrives. Evil contained is not evil destroyed. It nourishes itself, grows within its confinement, swells and rages until it works loose, and then it runs free.
And its magic, Will followed quickly. Has its magic grown also?
Some of the harshness faded from the other's visage, and he nodded. Fed in the same way, and practiced, for the evil ones warred with each other in their prison, driven nearly mad with need to release their hatred of what had been done to them.
Now it was the Veilman's turn to be silent. His face lowered into shadow, his arms wrapped protectively about his knees as he drew his legs up tightly to his chest. In the east there sounded the faint, distant thunder of the departing storm as it faded into the broken wall of the Wolfstag. A touch of impatience revealed itself in Al-Anon's dark face as he watched the young man. He leaned forward once more.
"Are all of your questions answered now, Will Ohmsford?"
The Veilman blinked.
"No."
His head lifted sharply.
"No, I have one more."
Al-Anon frowned.
"Indeed. Let's have it, then."
He was clearly displeased. Will hesitated, weighing inwardly the advisability of proceeding any further with this. He decided that he must. He chose his words carefully.
"Everything that I've heard suggests that these demons are more than a match for the elves. It seems from your own encounter with them that they are a match even for you."
There was anger now in the big man's face, but Will pushed ahead quickly.
"If I accompany the elven girl Amberley in search of the Bloodfire, as you have asked me, they will surely come after us. Suppose we are found. What chance do I stand against them, Al-Anon? Even with the elf stones, what chance do I have? You would not answer me before. Answer me now."
"Well." The druid rocked back slightly, the lean, dark visage suddenly expressionless in the firelight, creased in shadow.
"I thought this was all leading up to something." "Please give me an answer to my question," Will persisted quietly.
Al-Anon cocked his head reflectively.
"I don't know the answer."
"You don't know?" The Veilman repeated the words incredulously. The druid blinked.
"In the first place, I hope to keep them from finding you. If they cannot find you, they cannot harm you. At the moment, they know nothing of you at all. I intend that it should stay that way."
"But if they do find me, then what?"
"Then you have the elf stones."
He hesitated.
"Understand this, Will. The elf stones are a magic from the old world, a magic that existed when the elves first defeated these creatures. The power of the stones is measured by the strength of the man or woman who wields them. There are 3 elf stones, 1 each for the heart, mind, and body of the user,
All three must unite as one. When this is done properly, the power released can be very great.
He looked at the veilman sharply.
Do you understand, then, why I cannot answer your question? You will determine the strength of your defense against your enemies. It must come from within you, not from the stones themselves. I cannot measure that in you. Only you can do that. I can only tell you that I judge you to be as good a man as your grandfather. And I've met no better man, Will Ohmsford.
The veilman stared wordlessly at the druid for a moment, then looked down at the fire.
Nor have I, he whispered.
Al-Anon smiled faintly.
Your grandfather's chances seemed very poor when he went in quest of the Sword of Shannara. He would admit to that. The warlock lord knew of him from the beginning. The skull-bearers actually came into the vale in search of him. He was hunted every step of the way, yet he survived. And he did so despite his own considerable doubts.
He reached over and put his hand on Will's shoulder, the cavernous eyes glinting in the firelight.
I like your chances in this. I believe in you. Now you must start believing in yourself.
He took his hand away and rose.
We've talked enough this night. You need to sleep. We've a long ride ahead of us tomorrow.
He wrapped his black robes tightly about him.
I'll keep watch.
He started to move away from the veilman.
I can keep watch, Will offered quickly, remembering the druid's injuries.
You can sleep, Al-Anon grunted, and the night shadows swallowed him up.
Will stared after him for a second, then shook his head. Spreading his blankets next to the fire, he rolled himself into them and stretched wearily.
He would not sleep, the veilman told himself. Not yet. Not until he had taken time to consider carefully all that had been said this evening, until he had decided how much of it he should believe, until he was convinced that he knew what he was doing in all this. Not until then.
He let his eyes close for just a moment. Immediately he was asleep. Chapter 10. They resumed their journey at daybreak. Although the forest land still glistened damply with yesterday's rain, the skies were clear and blue and filled with sunlight as the pair rode southward along the fringes of the Anar. The drab emptiness of the Rab brightened into rolling grasslands, and the enticing smell of fruit-bearing trees was carried past them on a gentle morning breeze. Late that afternoon, they arrived at the legendary Silver River and came upon a company of dwarf sappers engaged in the construction of a footbridge at a heavily forested narrows. Leaving Will concealed in a copse of fir with the horses, the druid went down to the river's edge to confer with the dwarves. He was gone for a time, and when he returned, seemed preoccupied with something. It was not until they had remounted and were riding downriver away from the dwarves that he volunteered to Will that he had given warning of the danger to the elves and requested that the dwarves send aid as quickly as possible. One among the sappers had recognized the druid and had promised that help would be sent. Still, marshaling any sizable force would take time. Al-Anon left the matter there. Minutes later, they forded the Silver River at a shallows where a broad sandbar split the clear waters apart, and rock shallows slowed the current enough to permit horse and rider safe passage. From there, they rode south at a leisurely pace, watching the shadows they cast lengthen as the day wore on. It was nearly sunset when Al-Anon reined in Artak at the crest of a tree-lined rise and dismounted. Will followed him down, leading Spitter forward several paces to where the druid waited. They tethered the horses in a small grove of hickory and together walked ahead to where an outcropping of rocks split apart the wall of trees. With Al-Anon in the lead, they moved up into the rocks and peered out.
Below them lay a broad, horseshoe-shaped valley, its slopes and floor heavily forested, but open at its western end to grasslands that had been tilled and planted with farm crops. A village sat at the juncture between forest and field, and a narrow stream ran from the woodlands through the cluster of homes north across the top of the farmland, its waters irrigating the soil in dozens of neatly inscribed ditches. Men and women moved busily about the little community, tiny figures to the two who looked down on them from the valley rim. Far to the south, the grasslands ended in a rock-strewn lowland that stretched unbroken to the horizon and disappeared. Havenstead, Al-Anon announced, indicating the village and the farmlands. His finger lifted slightly and pointed into the lowland. Out there is the battle mound. Will nodded. What do we do now? The druid seated himself comfortably. We wait until it gets dark. The fewer people who see us, the better. The stores would say nothing in any case, but these villagers are free with their talk. Secrecy is still our greatest ally, and I don't intend to lose it unnecessarily. We'll go in quickly and quietly, and leave the same way. He glanced up at the sun, already beginning to drop rapidly into the western horizon. We only have about an hour. They sat together without talking until the rim of the sun was barely visible above the tree line, and the dusk had begun to slip her gray shadow over the length of the valley. Finally, Al-Anon rose. They walked back to where they had tied the horses, remounted, and started out once more. The druid led them eastward for a time, skirting the valley rim until they had reached a heavily forested section of the slope that concealed a narrow draw. There they started down. They wound their way slowly through the trees, watching the woodlands darken steadily into night, allowing the horses to pick their way through the brush. Will quickly lost all sense of direction, but Al-Anon seemed to know exactly where he was going and did not slow as he guided them forward. After a time, they reached the valley floor and travel grew easier. A clear, moonlit night peeked down on them through breaks in the forest roof, and night birds called out sharply at their passing. The air was sweet and heavy with the smell of the woods, and Will grew drowsy. Finally, scattered bits of yellow light began to flicker into view ahead of them, slipping through the screen of the forest, and the faint sounds of voices reached out through the stillness. Al-Anon dismounted, motioning for Will to do likewise, and they walked the horses forward afoot. The forest thinned out noticeably, clear of heavy brush and deadwood, and ahead of them they could see a low stone wall with a wooden gate. A line of tall evergreens bordered the wall and screened away most of what lay beyond, though it was clear to Will that they were at the eastern edge of the farming village and the yellow lights were the flames of oil lamps. Upon reaching the wall, they tied the horses to an iron post. Al-Anon put a single finger across his lips. Silently, they passed through the little wooden gate. What they found on the other side brought Will up short. A sweeping, terraced garden spread out before them, its tiers of multicolored flowers dazzling even in the pale moonlight. A stone walkway, glistening with flecks of silver, wound downward out of the gardens to a gathering of wooden benches, and from there to a small cottage constructed of timber and stone. The cottage was a single story with a loft and was fronted by the familiar open-air porch. Flower boxes hung below latticed windows, and thick, low bushes bordered the roughened walls. Crimson yews and blue spruce grew at the immediate front of the home. A second walkway ran from the porch beneath the arch of a magnificent white birch and disappeared through a hedgerow to a roadway beyond. In the distance, glimmerings of light from other cottages broke the night. Will stared at it all in wonderment. Everywhere there were touches of color and life, all with the look of something drawn from a child's storybook. Everything was perfectly ordered. He glanced questioningly at Al-Anon.
The mocking smile flashed briefly, and the druid motioned for him to come. They followed the pathway through the gardens to the benches, then moved on toward the cottage. Light shone brightly through the curtained windows of the little house, and from within came the low, gentle sound of voices. No, Will corrected himself, children's voices. He was mildly surprised at his discovery and very nearly missed seeing the fat, striped house cat that lay sprawled across the first step of the porch. He caught himself just in time to keep from stepping on the sleeping animal. The cat raised its bewhiskered face and stared up at him insolently. Another cat, this one coal black, scooted off the porch hurriedly and slipped down into the bushes without a sound. Druid and Veilman climbed the porch steps and moved to the front door. From within, the children's voices rose sharply in laughter. Al-Anon knocked firmly and the voices went still. Footsteps came to the other side of the door and stopped. "Who is it?" a voice asked softly, and the patterned curtains that screened a glass port parted slightly. The druid leaned forward, allowing the light from within to fall across his dark countenance. "I am Al-Anon," he answered. There was a long silence, then the sound of a latch drawn back. The door opened, and an elven girl stepped through. She was small, even for an elf, her body slender and brown with sun. Chestnut hair fell all the way to her waist, shadowing a child's face at once both innocent and knowing. Her eyes flashed briefly to Will, eyes that were green and deep with life, then settled once more on the druid. "Al-Anon has been gone from the Four Lands for more than 50 years." Her voice was steady, but there was fear in her eyes. "Who are you?" "I am Al-Anon," he repeated. He let a moment of silence pass. "Who else could have found you here, Amberley? Who else would know that you are one of the Chosen?" The elven girl stared up at him speechlessly. When she tried to speak, the words would not come. Her hands came together tightly. With a visible effort, she composed herself. "The children will be frightened if they are left alone. They must be put to bed. Wait here, please." Already there was a scurrying of small feet at the other side of the door and the faint whisper of excited voices. Amberley turned and disappeared back into the cottage. They could hear her voice, low and soothing, as she ushered the children up wooden stairs to the loft overhead. Al-Anon moved to a wide-backed bench at the other end of the porch and seated himself. Will remained where he was, standing just to one side of the door, listening to the sounds of the elven girl and the children from within, thinking as he did so, "She is only a child herself, for goodness sake." A moment later she was back, stepping lightly onto the porch, closing the cottage door carefully behind her. She glanced at Will, who smiled at her awkwardly. "This young man is Will Ohmsford." Al-Anon's voice floated out of the dark. "He studies at Storlock to become a healer." "Hello," Will began, but she was already walking past him to the big man. "Why have you come here, druid? If druid you are," she demanded, a mixture of anger and uncertainty in her voice. "Has my grandfather sent you?" Al-Anon rose. "Can we sit in the gardens while we talk?" The girl hesitated, then nodded. She led them from the porch back along the stone walkway to the benches. There she seated herself. The druid sat across from her, Will a little off to one side. The Veilman recognized that his role in this confrontation was that of a spectator and nothing more. "Why are you here?" Amberley repeated, her voice a bit less unsettled than a moment earlier. Al-Anon folded his robes about him. "To begin with, no one has sent me. I am here of my own choice. I am here to ask you to return with me to Arbalon." He paused. "I will be brief. The Elkris is dying, Amberley.
The forbidding begins to crumble. The evil within breaks free. Demons all. Soon they will flood the Westland. Only you can prevent this. You are the last of the chosen.
The last, she whispered, but the words caught in her throat.
They are all dead. The demons have found and killed them. The demons search now for you. Her face froze in horror.
No. What trick is this, druid? What trick?
She did not finish this either, but stopped as tears formed in her eyes and streaked her child's face. She brushed them away swiftly.
Are they really all dead?
All of them. The druid nodded. You must come with me to Arbalon. She shook her head quickly.
No. I am no longer one of the chosen. You know that.
I know that you would wish it so. The green eyes flared angrily.
What I would wish is of no matter in this. I no longer serve. That is all behind me. I am no longer one of the chosen.
The Elkris selected you as one of the chosen, Alanon replied calmly. She must decide whether you remain one. She must decide whether you shall carry her seed in search of the bloodfire, so that she may be reborn and the forbidding restored. She must decide. Not you. Not I.
I will not go back with you, Amberlee stated quietly.
You must.
I will not. I will never go back. This is my home now. These are my people. I have made this choice.
The druid shook his head slowly. Your home is wherever you make it. Your people are whomever you wish them to be. But your responsibilities are sometimes given.